Thank you, guys. You may all record this. Hopefully I don't say anything. They'll come back to haunt me. I don't intend on running for office, so whatever. Say whatever the fuck I want. This is Casey, wizard. I'm not really sure what his job is, but...
I'm the managing editor.
So you're the managing editor.
I'm a pretty big deal.
Right. So you are a big deal. Now,
no, not really.
So ask him whatever you want about wizards, because I guess he is one.
More of a warlock.
Now, so Casey, what am I talking about?
Oh, we're talking about you today, so...
All right, talking about what part?
Pretty much everything that you do.
All right. Basically, I'm not ashamed to say I'm the zombie guy. I guess I'll just give you a quick spiel about who I am, where I started. Who's heard me speak before? All right. Well, you guys pretty much know what I'm going to say. I was born in a log cabin in Illinois. about 10 years ago, longer than 10 years ago, before some of you were born, like you. What's your name?
Mary,
okay. Before you were born, there was something called Y2K. And what Y2K meant was this fear that people had that when the clock struck midnight 2000, the world was going to go to hell. I'm sure you heard your parents talking about it. I'm sure you were wondering why they were stocking up on canned goods. Because people really felt this way, Mary. They felt that, like, the missiles would launch, because the computers would all reset, and they would land on the banks, and they would destroy everything. And real people, grown-ups, thought this way. Not, like, crazy survivalists who actually wanted it to happen, but real adults with jobs and lives. And there, I don't know how it was up here. Probably the same as it was down in the States, but probably with a little less panic. But down in the States, we kind of lost our mind a little bit. People were really stocking up. And all these survival guides were coming out. And when I was reading them, I thought, well, what about for zombies? Because I'm not afraid of, all-out race wars and food wars and oil wars, but zombies. And I thought, all right, I'm going to go find a book on how to fight zombies, because somebody's written it, right? It's got to be out there. So I went and I looked and couldn't find it. Because apparently nobody either had the interest or the free time. Or they were all too afraid of looking like a complete geek. And I thought, well, you know what? I'm going to do it. I'm going to write about zombies. I'm going to write a zombie survival guide. And I honestly didn't think it was ever going to be published. Because who's going to want this? I mean, who is actually going to want a real book about something that's not real? So what I did was, when my day job was over, every night I sat down for like an hour and did some research and just kept cranking out like a couple pages or making some notes. And within a few years, I had this manuscript. And I thought, okay, like any good writer with something that you're passionate about, I stuck it in a drawer. And I thought, all right, I wrote it for me. I had a great time writing it. It was a wonderful exercise. It's done. Now I can go back to trying being a paid writer to pay the bills and write things that I think suck. And then a few years later, I was on Saturday Night Live. I was writing for this show. This is show we have down in the States. I'm sure you have something equivalent up here. This is whatever. Although, probably once one of your comedians gets funny, we take him. So, basically what happened was I met this book agent talking about zombie survival guide, and he said, I can get you published. And I'm like, yeah, you do that. And he did. And that'll teach me to ever question him again. So, it got published. And the problem was it got published in the humor section. Because... I don't know if you guys know about how publishing works, but basically it's all about marketing. It's all about sort of finding who you're going to sell this book to. And they thought, well, clearly this guy is so cool and he's so witty that he wrote this making fun of all this stuff, right? I mean, he's on SNL, he's a comedy guy, he's this hipster, and this is all like some sort of witty take on society and survivalism. No. And I kept trying to tell them this. I kept trying to say, no, look, I'm not as cool as you think I am. I'm an actual dork who just is really into zombies. And I really thought about it. I really thought, well, if there was a zombie outbreak, How would you really survive? What would you really need? And that's where the passion came from. And they were like, ha ha, you are so funny. Humor! So they put it in the humor section. And I spent the last, I don't know, 10 years trying to dig myself out of that hole. Because the thing is, as a sci-fi and horror geek, I know that, we as a tribe tend to be a little insecure. And we tend to be a little defensive, especially when we think someone is making fun of us. So what I did was immediately go to the guys at Fangoria, which is our room morgue. All right, and I said, look, just give me a chance, let me do some interviews, let me do some press to just sort of prove to sci-fi and horror fans out there that this wasn't meant as a cheap shot to, like, make money, clearly. This came from a real place of passion. So sort of bit by bit, year by year, I managed to convince people that, like, no, this is who I am. This is what I'm really into. And then a few years later, it came time to write another zombie book. Well, another book. And I thought, well, there's more zombie stories to tell. And I thought I didn't want to just do a conventional zombie story of, you know, a guy or a group of people with guns, and I got to get from point A to point B. Because everybody else is doing that. And some people are actually doing it quite well. I mean, I come from the point of view of a reader, not a writer. I thought, what would I want to read? And I didn't want to write just one of those stories because they're already out there. So I thought, what isn't out there? What do I want to read that I can't get? Just like Zombie Survival Guide. I wanted to read it, didn't exist, wrote it. So then I thought, okay, what kind of zombie story do I want to tell that doesn't exist that I want to read? And I thought, well, you know, my problem with a lot of not just zombie stories, but a lot of big apocalyptic stories is they tend to be very narrow. And that's fine, that's the way you tell it, but I always have more questions. You know, every big apocalyptic movie, it centers around one group of people. And then there's, like, maybe they have the TV on and you sort of see what's happening in Beijing, but that's about it. And that's the way you have to do it most of the time. But I thought, I want to do a big story. I want to tell stories from all around the world. And I specifically wanted it to be international. Because as an American, I think that, you know, as much as we are so fucking awesome, I think that we do have an Achilles heel. And I think our kryptonite is our isolationism. I think that we tend to think that there isn't much out there. It's just us. And which is why we consistently stick our dicks in anthills around the world. And we go, oh my God, wow! This is complicated and violent and they hate us. Who knew? And I thought, all right, I really want to make this an international book. Especially because a zombie outbreak is an international story. It's an apocalyptic story. It's a global story. So why not tell it from global perspectives? And one of my favorite books is called The Good War by Studs Terkel. And it's an oral history of World War II. It's stories of people who were in World War II from all different countries. Asia, Europe, there's probably a few Canadians somewhere in there. But I love that book, and I said, that's the format I want to do. So I started researching what would become World War Z. Where I am. So that was my second book. And thank God it wasn't in the humor section. People seemed to like it. Seemed like Zombie Survival Guide. And it came time to do another project. Now, for those of you, who's read Zombie Survival Guide? All right. Those of you who haven't, there's one woman in a green shirt and glasses who kind of looked around nervously. Like, wait a minute, am I in the minority? What's your name? Jocelyn. Okay, well, Jocelyn, here's the deal. Zombie Survival Guide, the first two-thirds of the book, how to fight zombies. It's pretty simple. The last third is a recording of zombie attacks throughout history. Excuse me, I'm a history nerd before I'm anything, so I always wanted to do that. Now, Jocelyn, some of them are really short, like paragraphs or sentences. I wanted to flesh them out. I want to see more. And I've always loved comic books, so I thought, why don't I take those stories and try to adapt them into sort of a comic book form? So found William Christensen at Avatar, and we collaborated. He said, do you want to do a zombie comic? And I said, yeah, but I don't want to just do a traditional zombie comic because there's plenty of really good ones out there. I want to see my stories illustrated. So we found this artist, Ibrahim Roberson. He lives in a tree in Brazil somewhere. Never met the man, by the way. It's all through email. And I wrote a script, my first comic book script, and it's called Zombie Survival Guide Recorded Attacks. So that's my third work. And, you know, I did a second one called World War Z. All right, just making sure we're, you know where you are. I don't want you to be like, wait a minute, I thought it was a Twilight panel. Who's this John Cryer-looking motherfucker? Because you never know. We want to make sure we all know why we're here. So, those are my three works. Now, what I have managed to consistently do, which I did not intend to do, but I'm quite proud of, is every time I do something, somebody somewhere looks at it and says, what the hell is this? Because everybody seems to draw their own conclusions of what they think it's going to be, and are consistently disappointed. Because my problem is, and I'm sorry to say this, I love you guys, thank you for, you know, paying my mortgage and sending my kid to college, but I don't write for you guys. Mainly because I have no idea what you want. If I knew what you wanted, if I knew how to please you, I would be writing sitcoms in Hollywood. All right? So she thought it was funny. She was like, yeah, sitcoms! Friends, yes. When I sit down to write, I have to start with me. Mainly because the only way I know how to avoid failure is to be proud of what I do and love the process. And that way, if it doesn't work out with you guys, at least I had a ball doing it, and therefore it's not a failure. If I sit down to think, well, what would you guys want? And that's what I do. And I go, okay, what would they want? Oh, they'd like this part. Yes. Oh, tits. Okay, yes. And then I put it out there, and you think it sucks, and I think it sucks. Well, then I've just wasted time. And that's a failure, because we only got so much time in this earth, and I'd like to spend it doing something that I love. So, like I said, Zombie Survival Guide, never intended to be funny. And I understand, even to this day, some people, they get it, and they're like, dude, where's the jokes, man? Like, or they say, it was funny for like the first 10 pages, and then the joke got old. And I'm like, there's no joke. If anything, the joke is on me, because I'm really into this stuff. And then World War Z, Zed. Like I said, I didn't want to do just a traditional main character and traditional linear story. People read it, where's the main character? But I want to do my thing. Same thing. Recorded attacks. I want to do a graphic novel. People, it's a graphic novel! Bottom line is, guys, I will continue to just do what I like. And sometimes people will like it, and sometimes people will go, what the hell is this? I've got a new comic book miniseries coming out from IDW Comics for G.I. Joe. In the States, we have this thing called G.I. Joe. They're real American heroes. They're very American. They have guns, and, you know, they shoot people. It's what we do. Sorry, it's how we roll down there. But it's called Hearts and Minds, and it's very different than a traditional G.I. Joe story. It's not a linear story. It's not particularly linear in that it's that we got our Joes and they got to do one mission. No, what it is it's five issues. Each issue is divided up into two separate stories. Each story is basically a day in the life of a Joe or a Cobra. It's like an up close and personal. What does it take to be one of these people? Where did they come from? What are their motivations? Who are they? Now I guarantee you, when people open this, some people are going to love it. Some people are going to say, "What the hell is this?" But I'm proud of it. It's coming out in May. And so that's pretty much, that's who I am. This is it, folks. I ain't opening for anybody. You know. So if anybody has any questions about who I am or what I do, feel free. Yes?
World War Z. It will be coming out.
Ah, yes. Now, this is important. Let's get this out of the way first. The movie, World War Z. Okay. Here's what I know, and here's what you know. Brad Pitt's company, yes, it's Brad Pitt, he's optioned it. His company's called Plan B. And he's taken it under his wing, and he said, okay, I mean, I think by this point he knows that it's his. Maybe when it was first optioned, I think he was in Africa adopting somebody, but I think by this point he knows this is mine. We have a director, Mark Forster, who is, I met the man, he's surprisingly excited about it. I expected him to be more neutral. He's Swiss. And he's very enthused. Which I honestly, and he's German-Swiss, so I never thought in my life I would be sitting down with a German saying, "Yeah, don't give up, you're just so wonderful, just you're Jew, you're so talented, yeah." I got nothing against the Germans, I have a dachshund, so it's cool. We had a writer, J. Michael Straczynski, who wrote a first draft, which that draft I have read. And I will tell you, I'm not supposed to say this, as the book writer, no matter how good the script is, you're supposed to say, "It's horrible, they eviscerated it, they're killing my baby." No, Joe's script was really freaking good. Now, there have been subsequent drafts, which I have not read, and now they've brought on another writer, a Matt Carnahan, which is no reflection on Joe. The way it works in Hollywood is, I think there's some rule, like you have to have at least 17 writers. And that's true, like when you guys all go see a movie and you see written by, no. Here's what you're seeing. You're seeing the first guy who wrote a script and the last guy who did a pass on it. There's a million guys in the middle. They bring in people to do punch-ups, they call it punch-ups, on dialogue or on one scene. I mean, you should see the kind of scripts that I read just from friends in Hollywood where there's like 17 names on there. So I don't know what the process is going to be. I don't know how far it's going to go. The last time I spoke to them, I call them because, you know, the problem is, they don't deal with you guys. I do. So I'm kind of like the White House press secretary who has to sort of sit there and, the president's policy is, Katrina. Well, there's one girl in the back. I said, "Katrina, you can't
say that. He's a zombie guy."
Yes. Bottom line is, last time I spoke to them at Plan B, they're all super psyched and they can't wait to do it. But, you know, look, the one inherent strike against this movie is if you make it, it's got to be big. All right? You can't just do like a little indie zombie film. This thing has to be epic or you can't do it. So it's that simple. So when you have that much money, executives tend to get really nervous. All right? They're like, I always say this, somewhere in a studio basement, there's a dude being waterboarded who greenlit Speed Racer. All right, because when you have a flop, that's a lot of money. I mean, literally, there is a guy going, "Please let me out," and then the head of the studio is like, "It rubs the lotion off the skin." So when you put that contract in front of studio executives, "Oh, World War Z, $11 billion budget," they're like, "I think it needs another 12 drafts," which basically means like, then I won't have the job when they greenlight it. And if it does greenlight, they can say, "Yes, I supported it. That was my baby." So we shall see. We shall see. I will say that as projects go, there is an unusual amount of excitement. I haven't seen this much excitement in a project in a long time. So we'll see. Anyone else? Green Hat.
What's your wish list for the film? Is there anything from what you wrote that you absolutely want to see in the film?
Yes. I can tell you the one thing that I do want to see, and that is absolutely no presence whatsoever of Michael Bay. Someone said, "Ooh, ooh, yeah, woo." No, I'm sorry. I mean, look, I'm sure he's good at what he does, and people, look, Bumblebee. When did Bumblebee become a Camaro, by the way? It's supposed to be a little beat. Well, anyway, it's a different panel. So yes, as long as they can keep him far away, and as long as there's no, like, tween love thing, where, like, there's a little tween, and she's in love with, and he's, "I love you," and then somebody jumps in the air and turns into a chihuahua. Whatever. Just, That's it. As far as anything else, it's fair game. You know, as long as it's good, as long as people love what they're doing, let's hope it's a good movie. Anyone else? Yes?
Do you have any concept or any idea of what a new zombie novel would be, or if you have anything that would type, maybe?
Oh, am I writing a new zombie novel? No. No. I mean, the truth is, I can't say I haven't been offered. Everybody wants me to write another zombie novel. And the truth is, I can't, like I said, I can't do a zombie novel just because other people want me to do it. Because then you get on that hamster wheel of just trying to write for your audience. And I think it's a losing proposition. If there is another zombie book in me, it's going to be because I can't not write it. I don't know if that makes sense. It's the kind of thing where the thoughts just don't leave you. You know, everything I've written, it's because I have to do it. There are these stories that I have to tell. And if it's another zombie book, you'll know. Like, oh, wow, Brooks wrote another zombie book. He must have really wanted to do it.
Do you take a serious vein in your writing because your father is a comedian?
Do I take a serious vein? You know, guys know who my dad is. Avery Brooks? Sisko? No, I mean, that's the thing. I'm a different animal than my dad, and it's nothing that I can control. My father is a much more social writer. He likes to write in a writer's room, and for me, I'm much more of a hermit. It's not like I sit down and I'm like, yeah, no Nazis, fuck you, Dad. No, it's... he does what he does, and I do what I do, which, by the way, everyone, Young Frankenstein playing in Toronto right now. So I may go see it tonight. I have to do what I have to do, and no influence, either studios or crowds or my old man, can do anything about it. Anyone else? Superman.
Okay. What stories, zombie stories, really influenced you before you started writing your first book?
You know, I wasn't so much he asked what zombie stories influenced me, and I wasn't so much influenced by zombie stories as I was by other stories. Like I said, The Good War by Studs Terkel, that influenced me. You know, people ask me when I wrote Zombie Survival Guide, like, did you watch a lot of zombie movies? No. I mean, I had one, the original Dawn of the Dead. Best zombie movie ever made. That's all I needed. Everything else came from reality. Oh, she's walking out. She's like, he didn't watch a bunch of zombie movies? Oh, screw him. Gary Shanley lip looking. Anyway. No, I tend to draw from other places and bring them into my zombie stories, as opposed to taking other people's zombie stories and doing something with them. Anyone else? Yes?
When you're writing World War Z, in some sense it's a chronological order, but because all the stories are different, did you have the politics of this world in mind first, or how did that process work? Like, for example, you got near the end of the book or somewhere in the middle, like Cuba's like the number one country.
All right, no. I didn't start out, as many of my critics say, with some sort of political agenda. I mean, the truth is, I just looked objectively at the world we were living in right now and said, okay, if there was a zombie outbreak, logically, how would different countries react? And the truth is, no, I'm not particularly pro-Cuban or pro-Castro. I love their rum, but that's about it. But the truth is, look, you have the island of Cuba, which is separated by an ocean. It's also a militaristic society. It is able to close its borders and lock down. Everyone in Cuba is in the militia. Everyone is ready for an invasion. They've been planning for an invasion since the Bay of Pigs. So when the invasion does happen, they're ready. So logically, Cuba would become a winner just by default, as opposed to, say, other countries like China, which would implode. You know, I'm not particularly anti-China, it's just that I looked at how they dealt with SARS. And that's where I based the zombie outbreak on, which was if they dealt with SARS in such an ass-backwards way, I mean, let's face it, you guys got SARS, okay, because of them. This is a long way from China. So that's where I sort of based it on. Whereas, like in Zombie Survival Guide, I base a lot of the logic on AIDS, because I'm a child of the AIDS generation, where... Let's face it, folks, you could have cured AIDS with a pamphlet. It was this tiny little disease, and had we done the right thing, it would have been a footnote in a medical textbook. But we screwed it so badly that the genes out of the bottle will never get it back. So that was one of the premises of World War Z, which is it's not the problem, it's completely screwing up the solution. You know, people talk about in World War Z about the Battle of Yonkers. And some of my countrymen. That would never happen! U.S. Army kicks some ass! Yeah!
You ever been in the Army?
No! Yeah! There's a lot of those weekend warriors who really don't like me. But the truth is, no. I based it on actual military tactics. To the point that I was invited to speak a few months ago at the U.S. Naval War College. Talking about basically how close I nailed it with World War Z. Because it's true. When you guys fight a battle... Firepower is like this much of a battle. There's timing and training and logistics and planning and terrain and intel. There's a lot of things that can go horribly, horribly wrong. I based the Battle of Yonkers specifically on a battle fought by our mutual mother country, Great Britain, and it was called East Lanawanna, where in the later part of the 19th century, Queen Victoria's army, the best army in the world, marched into South Africa with the 50-caliber Martini Henry rifle and cannons and horses and rockets, and they were up against Zulus with cowhide shields and soft iron spears, and they were massacred. 800 men marched into battle. None of them came out. Gutted to a man. The best army in the world versus the most primitive. If that can go wrong, yes, the Battle of Yonkers can happen. Anyone else? Yes?
What was your inspiration for Distress, the Department of Strategic Resources?
Oh, the Department of Strategic Resources. It's funny, because a lot of people say, well, why did you spend so much time about the economy and reorganizing? Well, that's the kind of stuff that gets me going in the morning. I love that stuff. I based it on how the U.S. reacted in World War II. You know, that's the thing, is what I love about my country is we can do some amazing things when we get kicked in the ass. And we literally don't know the meaning of the word impossible. I mean, we say, okay, it's World War II. We have to completely reorganize the country. In the Second World War, FDR, after Pearl Harbor, Franklin Roosevelt sat down with the heads of the auto industries and said, I need you to produce so many thousand tanks a month. And they said, Mr. President, we can't do that. Because if we do that, that will impede our ability to produce cars. And he said, you don't understand. We're not producing any more cars until this war is over. That's it. And they said, you want us to completely change our factories? Everything? No cars, no washing machines, no ovens, no appliances? Yeah. And we're going to have to do that to win. And we did. You know, you look at World War II, what the American economy, which was a very market-based economy, was all, you know, fat and dumb and lazy and happy, and we just got off our asses and did what had to be done. So that was my inspiration, was we can do that. Yes, we can. Anyone else? Yeah. Why do I write instead of doing something else?
Yeah,
I can't do anything else. I'm not qualified to do anything else. This is what I love. This is what I've been doing since I was 12 years old. When I was 12 years old, I wrote my first short story. Wrote it for me, stuck in a drawer. I was writing ever since then. I was 14 years old, wrote my first novel, stuck in a drawer. I wrote for me, and only for me, because it was the only thing that kept me happy. I am what you call very, very dyslexic, which means that school was really, really hard for me. I was tutored every day from like the age of 10 to the age of 17, just to get through the day. So school was really hard, and there was no joy in it. And I have no interest in sports. Still don't. I don't get it. You know, well, why does everybody make such a big deal about a piece of inflated rubber?
Yeah.
Great, I got the ball, yeah. Well, if you got it, don't throw it away. Take it home. So in school, not into sports, not good in academics, writing was the only thing that gave me joy. I could escape into my own world. And that's sort of always been me. So I can't not write. And that's why I do it. Anyone else? Yeah.
Just wanted to say thank you for not writing a pussy vampire novel.
Look, let me tell you something. If I could write a pussy vampire novel, I would. You know how much money they make? Look, guys, I'm not... Let's be straight about something, okay? I'm not trying to be some sort of rogue rebel like, I gotta write for me, you know, man. No, the truth is, if I tried, I would fail. I am genetically incapable of trying to please you guys. Look, I was on Saturday Night Live for 2 seasons. They fired my ass. Now, I could say, like, oh, no, they just didn't renew my contract. No, they fired my ass. Because I couldn't please you guys. I would write stuff, and they'd be like, yeah. And I would be like, yeah. It's not who I am. If I had that ability to sit down and be like, okay, vampire novel. Yeah, all right. There's a teen, and she's in love, and he loves her, and he loves her a lot. And then there's a werewolf, yes. And a smog monster, and he loves her. Yeah, okay. Are you kidding? I'd be on you know, book number 37 at this point. So no, I can only do what I'm capable of doing. All I'm capable of doing is writing for me.
Well, thanks anyway.
You're welcome. Anyone else?
Your
Way back.
Did any television shows influence you when you were growing up that made you write about, include certain themes or plots into your...
Oh, yeah. Is there any television shows that influenced me? Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, before you were born, there was a show called Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea. I used to watch it religiously. I mean, I watch it now on DVD. It's the gayest show. My God. I mean, they just took science and just threw it out the window. But I used to love science fiction. I was always a science fiction nerd. But I was always a history nerd. Like, I used to watch documentaries as a kid. Like, how lame is that? I was literally like an 11-year-old kid, and I'm watching like World War II documentaries. And documentaries like how it's made and science. And I was always into that stuff. So yeah, there was Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea, Star Trek, the original Battlestar Galactica. Oh, what a show. And I thought it went on for like 5 years, and I look back, I'm like, that was one season. Okay. The original Buck Rogers, which, I mean, Aaron Gray is here. And by the way, the guy that looks like her father, no, that's Gil Gerard. He's here too. I was like, oh my God, that's Gil Gerard. Wow, and Aaron Gray, she looks as good as she looked in Silver Spoons. But, you know, science, as you all know, science fiction is something that you marry, whereas comedy is something that you date. You know what I mean? Like, you're into comedy for a little while, you watch a comedy show, and then it's over. And you sort of leave it behind. Whereas science fiction, you can be a sci-fi fan of the same show for 100 years. Like, you know Aaron Gray is not here for the Silver Spoons fans, which ran a lot longer than Buck Rogers. But no, I mean, there's a lot of guys right now going up to Aaron Gray going... and, because it creates a world that we want to live in. And there's nobody who wanted that more than me when I was a kid. You know, I wanted to live in that world because when you're a dyslexic kid with no interest in sports, the world as it was didn't hold a lot of interest. So I had to escape into my own. Anyone else? Yeah.
What's your take on 2012?
Oh, 2012? Oh, that was awesome. When the world comes to an end, I'm hanging with John Cusack. I mean, that man is blessed. That man can drive faster than an earthquake in a limo. And he goes under bridges, and just the ass backwards luck that he falls into. Like, we need an airplane. I have an airplane. Excellent. We need a pilot.
I have a pilot.
Excellent. And then they get on the plane. Oh, we need to fly to China. Oh, we don't have enough gas. We need a bigger plane. Look, there's one. Wow. No, guys, look, when the world comes to an end, go to John Cusack's house, because, I mean, apparently, no, the guy, I wish life was like a Roland Emmerich movie. Like, how cool would that be? There's aliens coming, and they invade the world, and they're immune to everything we throw at them. And then the Fresh Prince and the Fly get into, they have an old iMac, and they manage to completely disable their entire computer network with witty jokes about fat ladies. That would be awesome. No, I mean, look, Roland Emmerich, he makes the movies that we would like to live in. I mean, when I was in graduate school, I was at film school in D.C., and I did a semester in Prague. And we had all these, this was like 1995, 96, we had all these old communist teachers, and they did the Hey, the Medic and movies, and the Medic, and the literally, as they're damning American films, outside the window, I shit you not, lines around the block for ID4. Because it's a feel-good movie, and I want to, look, the whole frickin' world came to an end in 2012. Millions of innocent people, men, women, little kids, die. But at the end of the movie, you still feel good. How did he do that? I don't know. I can't wait to see his take on Rwanda. You know? Anyone else? Yes. Any other writers I would want to collaborate with? No, because I'm not a collaborator. This was my problem. You know, I mean, this is what I learned actually when I was writing for SNL. Is the way it works is you write all night, and that's just a tradition. And it started in the 70s when people used to do mountains of cocaine, which they don't do anymore on the show, but the tradition is still there. So we have to sit up all night and write any sketches and submit it. And then when the sketches get picked, you have to rewrite them all. And you sit in a big room and you rewrite. And I used to sit there and be like, because, I mean, we an hour on one joke and everybody riffing, how about this and that? And I'd be like, fuck me. Can we just finish this and go home? And I remember complaining to one of the writers, Eric Slovin. Do you guys know Dimitri Martin. Yeah, well, Sloven and Allen, they were his writers, and so I knew them very well, very cool guys. And I said to Sloven once, I'm like, what the fuck, man? And Sloven was like, oh, you know, people, they take a lot of time because, you know, people are having a good time. And I was like, oh, that's fun for people. Oh, well, then I'm the asshole. That's not their problem. They're there to riff and have a good time and write a show. I'm the douchebag who's doesn't fit in. And then I realize, like, I'm not a collaborator. So it's not SNL's fault. They should have fired my ass. I would have fired my ass. So that's the problem with collaboration. Is it would have to be somebody so super awesome. And there are plenty of people out there, but I wouldn't trust my ability to collaborate. Anyone else? Yes?
Are there any Saturday Night Live skits of yours?
All right, Saturday Night Live skits. This is what happened. People come up to me and they're like, oh, dude, you are on SNL. Which sketches did you write? And then I tell them and they go, don't remember those. I actually was doing an interview once and someone, you know, when you do a lot of radio interviews, the DJs have no idea who you are. And they asked a lot of dumb questions, and one of them was like, so I understand, like, you wrote for SNL in the early 80s? I'm like, yeah, I was 12. I'm like, dude, I'm 37. How did I write in the early 80s? So no, the answer to your question, I wrote a few. I was proud of a Superman sketch that I wrote, first one I got on the air with Hugh Jackman. Super cool guy, by the way. I was very proud of a sketch I wrote with Robert De Niro, which is amazing, because it was one that we pre-taped. And you know, De Niro was like, yeah, just call me Bob. And I'm like, okay, yeah, Bob. And we shoot it, and we tape it, and the director says, I'm okay with that. And he says, good. You okay with that, Max? And he meant it. He's, you know, I'm the writer. You okay with that? And I have to pretend like I'm his equal. And that was the best piece of acting I've ever done. And I'm just like, yeah, Bob, that was good. I'm proud of those. I'm definitely proud of those. Anyone else? Do I have a creative dry spell and do I force myself? Yeah, I force myself to write. When I have a creative dry spell, I just power through it. And, you know, look, probably what I have powered through is just going to suck balls, but it's okay because I'm going to rewrite it anyway. You know, the way it works for me is the hardest way to write is to write the first draft. That's the most intimidating because there's nothing more intimidating than a blank page. And when I approach a first draft of anything, it's pure ego. I am so in love with myself. When I'm writing the first draft, I'm like, oh my God, this is so good. Yeah, Mark Twain can suck it. And I love it. And then I come back, let it, you know, go do something else, try to be objective. And then I come back all critical. And I'm just like, oh my God, this is so bad. This is horrible. And that's when I just have to just rip it apart, start over, be my harshest critic, and then put that draft aside, and then come back a little bit later and say, oh, okay, objectively, maybe it doesn't suck as much as I thought. But the problem with dry spells are just, it's anxiety, you know, and the only way to conquer that is just do it and do it and do it and do it. Like, if you see old footage of Tiger Woods when he was like 4, and his dad was making him do it, I mean, that's the thing. For him playing golf, it's just natural. And the hardest part about writing, it's like doing anything. You just have to do it and do it and do it so it becomes so normal for you that it just becomes part of your day. Because you just get up every morning, sit down, do it. And good or not, well, you can. That's what editing is for. So that's what I do when I have a dry spell. Anyone else?
Do you do most of your writing at home? And are you living in California then?
Yes, I live in California. Do I? Well, the funny thing about doing my writing at home is I moved to California from New York. I was actually from California. Moved to New York to write for SNL, took my wife, my new baby, came back to LA, bought a house, bought the property next to it where I was building, with my World War Z money, a guest house where I was going to have a home office where I was going to write. Now, in the meantime, I was like, oh, crap, what do? I don't want to waste money renting office space. So my dad's house was like 10 minutes away, and he has this big office. I mean, I'm sorry, he has a big attic, which I thought I could turn into an office. There's nothing there, he never goes up there, and I can use it to temporarily write in. And it was cool, I would get to see my dad, you know, every morning. I'd be like, hey, Dad, how's it going? He'd go to work, I'd go up to write. So then the guest house got done. My dad comes, looks at it, and goes, oh, it's good. Yeah, it's beautiful. you're not gonna write in there all the time. No, Dad. No, I built it for fun. So now I still write at my dad's place because he wants to see me every morning, and it's fine. I get to see him. I mean, I only have I don't know how much more time I got with the guy. So sort of every minute counts. So that's where I write, in my dad's house. How's that for infantilizing? And the truth is, at this point now, like, I wait for him to go to work, and then when he does go to work, I sneak back home into my office because he doesn't know when I go home. But the point is, I'm at that point in my life where there's things that are actually more important than writing, like being a good son and being a good dad. Anyone else?
Any writers that you hate?
Any writers that I hate? Yeah. I'm not going to talk about them because I just don't think that's cool. I mean, like, there's a couple writers that, like, that criticize me, like, up-and-comers, and I'm like, dude, first of all, you're not supposed to do that. You don't criticize other writers. You know, it's like in Beverly Hills Cop when they ask Eddie Murphy, do you wish to file charges against Taggart? And he goes, look, where I'm from, cops don't file charges against other cops. You know, I just feel like, look, everybody's entitled to write. Everybody's entitled to do their own stuff. I may personally think it's lame, or I may personally think that they suck and they're sellouts and whatever. But that's my opinion. And I don't want to try and influence anybody else with my opinion, because that's not cool. Anyone else? Yeah.
Has the success of a book like Walking Dead or any of the recent zombie films had any impact on me?
Has the success of Walking Dead or any zombie stuff had any effect on me? No, I mean, as far as Walking Dead goes, you know, kudos to Kirkman, because he was writing the same time I started. You know, both of us started about the same time. Well, I got published the same time he started, when nobody else was doing it. I mean, that's the thing. Kirkman was like, I'm going to write a zombie comic. Nobody else was doing that. So you know he started from a point of passion. And that's a pure motive, and that gets my respect any day. And yeah, now everybody's writing zombie stuff, and so much of it is just so bad, and it just stinks of sellout, of just like, I can make a buck off this. Now, I don't care. I've had my moment in the sun, and it was a damn good moment. I've had more success than I should ever deserve. What upsets me about so many people flooding the market is that there might be some young up-and-comers who really want to tell a zombie story. They really want to do this, and it's a story they have to tell, and it's burning in them. And the problem is they may not get published, and they may not get press, or someone has gotten ahead of them and done a shitty version of their story just to make money. You know what I mean? Like, some of you right now might be thinking, like, there's a zombie story I've wanted to do for 10 years, but, like, I haven't really formed it, or I haven't gotten the guts to write it, or whatever. And the point is, when you write it and you publish it, there may be someone else that says, no, we don't want this because it's been done. And that's the problem I have with this sort of flood. I wish people, it's like, look, if you just want to make money, please go do something else. You know, don't dilute and pollute this little subgenre, you know, with your crap just because you want to make a quick buck. You know, that's the problem I have with some of it. And some stuff, some of the other stuff, some of the novels, some of the movies, some of the comics, like Kirkman, awesome. You know, keep on keeping on. Anyone else?
Any of your anecdotes from World War Z, is there one in particular that you're really proud of, or that the character you created that you just really love?
Well, the funny thing is, everything in World War Z is based in history. Because, like I said, I'm a history nerd. So what I did was, I wanted to base everything in reality. I mean, you can ask me any anecdote in World War Z, and I'll tell you what it's taken from. I didn't make... What's that?
The asshole pharmaceutical guy.
Oh, the pharmaceutical guy. Oh, all right. In World War Z, I have this guy who's selling a fake cure for the zombie plague. Well, that's based in two real stories. One of them, you know, his defense was based on a real conversation I had with someone defending Enron, who's a shithead businessman. And this is what they do. What shithead businessmen do is they don't break the law, but they creep right up to the law. And they look at it, and then they piss on it. But there's this difference between what's legal and what's moral. And businessmen, they break that all the time. So it was based on that moral justification of like, oh, well, that's the market, that's capitalism. Hey, we didn't tell these people to do, we didn't put a gun to these people's heads, so they invested in us, they lost their life savings. That's what they do.
Yeah.
The cure itself was based on something I read about when I was in South Africa, that people were selling a cure for AIDS on the street. And it was just an industrial cleaner. Now, that's horrible enough, but get this. At the, what was it, the World Health Expo? I believe it was right here in this city a few years ago. The South African Ministry of Health, the government. You know what their pavilion was? You know what their cure was for AIDS? Garlic and beetroot. I'm not kidding you. They literally said a healthy diet and exercise and whatever will keep AIDS away. And it was a national scandal, and it almost brought down their government. That's the government. So that's where that came from. Yeah, he went, huh, yeah. Yeah, huh. Yeah, sometimes governments really suck. But that's where everything comes from, something. For me, my personal favorite was one that none of you care about. The guy who's in the deep diving suit that fights underwater. I always loved that kind of work. I've always been a big fan of atmospheric diving suits. And nobody was into that one. Nobody likes that one. Which is fine. I like it. And then a few weeks ago, I was aboard the USS John C. Stennis, which is an aircraft carrier. The Navy flew me out, VIP tour, and I toured the ship, and I met the crew, and I slept right underneath the flight deck as the Hornets were crashing down. Hey, keep it down! But I met a chief petty officer who was a big fan of my book, and he said, dude, that diver, I know those guys, and you nailed them. You nailed their personality. That's how they are. And I'd never met one of those guys. I was just hoping. And I was like, whew, thank you. So yeah, that's probably one of my favorites.
Follow up. The rep from Distress that you've been there that talks about how military guys come standard, because he pretty much was above them. Is that a little bit of you, maybe?
No. Yes, if the guy who's charge of the I'll say the ministry, I'm in Canada, the Ministry of Strategic Resources, constantly gets in fights with the military. Because the military wants their big budget military programs, and they hate it when civilians cancel them. No, that happens all the time. I mean, we just had a national scandal down in the States where the U.S. Air Force put all its money and all its resources and all its time into the F-22, which is this Raptor and its air superiority, and it can take out anything that flies. Well, the problem is, our enemies don't fly anymore. They hide in caves and they put on explosive vests. And the Raptor doesn't help that. So the defense secretary, a civilian, canceled the program. And they went berserk. And this is what happens in militaries all the time. When the military gets really excited about a program, they sort of even forget why they needed it in the first place. They just sort of want it. And that's what I based it on, is the constant fight of military procurement. You guys have here. You guys bought, well, actually, the sad thing is you do need them now. Your Navy bought 6 British Upholder-class submarines, diesel-electric, best in the world. Now, when it happened, there was a national fear. We don't need these. We're Canada. We're nice and polite. What do we need these for? Dolphins? Well, the truth is now that the polar ice caps are melting and the Russian Navy is claiming the Arctic, now you do need them. And we discussed those at the War College, of Canada having to become a naval power. So, no, that's based in reality. And the guy is based on a real guy who's a friend of mine, Arthur Levitt, the chairman of the SEC. I grew up with him, and he was a money cop his whole life, was taking on, you know, big organizations. So I based it on him. Anyone else?
Have you traveled to most of the places you write about?
Have I traveled to most of those places? I've traveled to some. I've been to South Africa. I've been to other countries in Africa, and I used to work for the BBC, so I lived in England, and I've been to Russia. I haven't been in the Middle East. I'll go when it calms down. I've been to Australia, New Zealand. I've been to Cuba. I've been to Cuba, so any FBI guys, whatever, here I am. I've been to Greenland. I went camping in Greenland once by myself. Stupid. Really stupid. You see that movie Into the Wild, or read the book? That totally could have been me. They could have, you know, and I would have died in the celebrity, you know, they would have, celebrity son douchebag dies in the Arctic, and that would have been my epitaph. So no, I did travel to a lot of them. In other countries, I interview people that have lived there or traveled there. I had a friend of mine who works for our government, and I can't say what he does, But whenever he goes to a country, I would ask him very specific cultural things, like the China stuff, like, you know, what's a slang word for poor person? Like, what do rich people call poor people, or things like that. So yeah, I mean, I try to really do my homework when I do this stuff. And this actually is because I'm dyslexic. I'm kind of the intellectual equivalent of a kid who was beat up in high school and then becomes like an Ultimate Fighter champion. Because like, I'm always that dyslexic kid who tries and tries and tries and still can't pass his exams. So whenever I sit down to do something, I really need to do my homework. And I get obsessed about getting it right. And I want to get the littlest details. Anyone else?
The Japanese refer to zombies as
seafood. Siafu, yeah.
Where did that idea come from?
Well, I just thought that the Japanese wouldn't have to have a Japanese word for them. They're a very cosmopolitan island. This isn't Japan of the 1930s. And an internet geek would certainly have a name for it. So that's where I came up with the idea of the driver ant. Because zombies are like driver ants in a way. They do swarm over you and strip you to the bone. So I thought that was a very appropriate term for the Japanese. By the way, the character... The Japanese kid who has that condition where he can't leave his bedroom, that's a real condition in Japan. There are kids diagnosed with that who have not left their bedroom in years. This intense, intense social anxiety disorder that we can't even fathom. And I'm sitting with a bunch of nerds, and we can't fathom this. You know, they make us look like W. How y'all doing? You know. Anyone else? How are we doing on time, by the way?
We're doing good.
We're doing good. All right. More. Way back in the hat, Yankees.
Talking about governments and all of that, I'm curious what your take on 9/11 is and the 9/11 conspiracy theories
All right. Here's my take on the 9/11 conspiracies. Here's my take on most conspiracies. Look, conspiracies happen. Yes, they do. But most of the time, they don't happen as well as you think. Okay? Because most conspiracies are carried out by people, and people screw up, and usually it really gets exposed, okay? You know, I wish it was, you know, it'd be awesome if conspiracies were like the X-Files, where everybody just knew what they were doing, it was secret, quiet, black vans, and smoking guys. No, most of the time, a freaking third-rate burglar gets caught in the office of the Democratic Party, and it brings down a whole freaking administration. That's usually how conspiracies work. But here's the thing about why I think most people like conspiracies, because at least somebody's running the show. You know what I mean? Is I think most people like the idea that someone is in charge, even if they don't agree with them, even if they think they're evil. Most people would rather have an evil boss than chaos. Most people are absolutely batshit scared of chaos. And it makes people feel a hell of a lot better to know that the CIA, working in concert with the mob, and Lyndon Johnson, and Bell Helicopters, and the Army, and it took all of these forces working together well to kill JFK. Because at least these forces are all working well. That's a hell of a lot easier to swallow than some freaking nut job with a rifle kills the President of the United States. That's freaking terrifying. That the entire country, that the entire world history can turn on a dime? That things are that chaotic? I mean, look, after Katrina, people were like, George Bush blew up the levees. What? That would be awesome, because then at least George Bush was doing something right. It's a hell of a lot easier than the fact that we had, in the words of Penn Jillette, the most fuck-upinest administration in about 100 years. So that's my thing about conspiracies. Dude, sometimes they happen, a lot of times they don't. A lot of times it's just random chaos, and it's not fair, and it's not right. You know, AIDS was not released, you know, as a punishment from the Reagan administration. It's a disease, and it got out of the bottle, and people screwed up and didn't do their jobs. Thank you. So that's how I feel. Anyone else?
Time for one more question.
Time for one more question. Dude, it's all on you. Stand up and make it good. Stand up, come on. If I have to stand up, so do you. Let's do this.
What's your take on digital flyers and file sharing? How it's impacted comics and novels?
That's what you asked. We just talked about 9/11, JFK, and you want to talk to me about Napster. I'll tell you this, it hasn't affected me. I will say that the good thing about the digital revolution, which is awesome, which is all of you can get published. You know, there was a time, like 10 years ago, when the way publishing worked was publishers needed to print like 30,000 copies of a book. They had to rent time on printing presses. And that's why if you would come to them with your book and they'd say, well, we don't think we can sell 30,000 copies. It's not worth our investment. Well, nowadays, you can sell one book at a time. You know, you can print on demand. Half the zombie books out there are self-published, which is awesome, which is guys with ideas. And they just put up a web page on Amazon and, you know, Dinner of the Dead, whatever. And they sell 15 copies. And who cares? They get their dream. Their book lives. Their book exists. How great is that? So I'm all for that. We're going to do one more question. I'm sorry. We can't. Somebody better ask about the nature of man or something. We better go on out on a high note. Somebody.
Not too much
pressure.
Oh,
yeah. Now they're all scared. Now they're like, pressure. Oh, man. See? A woman. No, wait. I'm just, look, there's an actual study. There have been many studies done that the number one fear of women is physical pain. The number one fear of men, you know what it is? Humiliation. Men would rather be humiliated than hurt. So a woman's like, I don't care. I'll say it.
Right. So if zombies storm this room right now, what would be your plan of escape?
Okay. If zombies storm this room right now, see, if it was an American audience, I'd be like, well, you guys need to lock and load. But it's Canadian audience. So I will say, okay, everyone, move in an orderly fashion towards the nearest exit, no shoving, everyone queue, and slowly we'll get oot. And then I will run out.